Welcome to the Government CIO's Agile Advocate Podcast. I'm in the studios today with the Director of Innovation for GCIO, Greg Telsic.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be here.
So, as we do with all our other guests, tell us how you became the Director of Innovation for GCIO.
I wish I actually knew the answer to that question. Arguably, I've been in this business, so I've been in the federal contracting game for over 15 years now. And I think most of my projects have always been sort of those interesting, weird ones that not always been, there's never been like a just a process you could just pick up and run with. And so I'm used to sort of taking something new or looking at it at a problem and looking at it in a different way and coming up with a new solution. So arguably, I had worked in the past with Erin Mirsky, our VP for Digital here at GCIO. And, you know, she knew my capabilities there and asked if I would be interested in coming over to Government CIO and helping out over here.
So besides the obvious of innovation, what's your role? What do you do?
You know, that's a good question because my role seems to change almost on a daily basis. You know, so I have to be innovative. At one level, my job is to try to help drive innovation and new technologies into all of our digital projects. So that's, for example, looking at the FSC, where we've been doing work for the VA, where we've been doing more traditional Windows development and really trying to see how can we innovate there? How can we move it into the cloud? How can we maybe change to a more agile development methodology? Just in general, how can we do things better there? Because right now what we see is that, you know, we're supporting over 100 applications and that list keeps growing and growing and growing. And that's not a sustainable model. Right, their budget's not growing and growing and growing. It's you know sort of flat to potentially reasonably incremental growth just over time, but not at the level that they would necessarily need to keep supporting the growth in the application space.
So I've been working with those guys just recently. In fact, I'm going to be checking in with them this week. Talk specifically about some of the innovations that they're introducing into the VA space.
Okay, I think one of the real things they're really trying to drive is agile development and a DevOps architecture, right? So they have, again, they've been doing very much traditional software development where they're getting requests for features or enhancements, or they're looking and saying there's security changes we need to make or other, you know, technology improvements that have happened that we need to implement. And it takes them anywhere from weeks to months to potentially years, right? I'm not going to necessarily point out to some specific thing that they're, you know, it's taken a year, but it takes a long time often to just get through that process, right? You have to figure out, you do all your requirements definition, then you do your coding, then you do your testing. And then you usually end up at that point, you drag security into it. You make sure everything passes all your security tests. And then you finally go and request to get on the schedule to do your implementation. You get your implementation done, and then you finally deploy.
You're talking about the traditional.
That's the traditional method, right? Okay. And what we're trying to look at is, can we move them to a more agile DevOps-focused approach? So where they are, you know, working in a sprint, they're building code during that sprint. Security is involved at the, you know, from the onset, so they're mindful of that. As they're writing the code and checking it in, it's automatically being tested. So there's no a testing cycle anymore. You know, the security is being assured as it's going. And then when they're done, they can make a decision of whether they want to actually push that into production or if they want to hold, go do some more development, and then potentially move it to the next build. But, you know, I think the key is that they can do much more agile, much more dynamic. So they're not waiting. You know, it's not like they're doing one release a quarter. They can do as many releases as they need to.
So the Big C culture, how's that adapting to this approach?
You know, I think there are parts of the organization that are fairly, you know, I think there's a bit of resistance sometimes to change and people get set in their ways and this is how we do it. And I think they sometimes get too structured and too firm in that area. There are other people I think that are really willing to say, hey, that doesn't really work and we need to change. So you see both sides of it. I think what we're seeing now within the VA with some of the directives, you know, about moving to DevOps, moving to scaled agile, people are getting more appreciative of these type of opportunities. And I think they're seeing the value because they're, you know, what we find is often, for example, the software development teams, you know, they see operations as a barrier, as a hindrance, like they're in the way of getting our work done. Operations often sees development the same way, right? They've got their own patches and other upgrades they've got to do. And those developers keep changing things on us. So, you know, it goes both ways. And I think sort of when you look at like DevOps, particularly, where you're starting to say, hey, the people that are building the code and the people that are operating and maintaining the code are working together, and they're trying to figure out what makes the most sense overall. So it's not just we're going to do some software changes and, you know, let's ignore all the security problems. No, we're going to incorporate the security enhancements in, make sure it's all working together.
So I was over at the VA probably 4 years ago, and we're doing some work over there. And me and you are working on a project right now, DevOps implementation, trying to push that forward in the VA in a structured manner. I could tell you that the attitude 4 years ago and now what we're looking at right now is visibly, it's different. It's very different. People are starting to accept it. But sometimes, like you say, begrudgingly, it's like, okay, whatever. We'll give it a shot. Others are really flying forward with it and trying to put it, implement it, and take advantage of it kind of its capabilities.
I think what's really helping here is I think the leadership has embraced it. So it's not just people at the ground level, the ones doing the work that are complaining about how it's done or how it's not being done. I think now what you've got is you've got leadership acknowledging that there are broken processes and broken things that need to be fixed, and this is not sustainable long term. And, you know, I think it's one thing people often at the lower levels, right, they'll grumble, but they don't see it from their leadership and they're afraid to necessarily speak their mind or really push. I think it's different when leadership is saying, we can't keep doing it the way we've been doing it, right? That's an unsustainable model and we need to change. And not pointing fingers. Right. Not saying you guys are doing it wrong, just saying we are doing it wrong.
That's a key term.
And, you know, together we need to come up with better solutions.
Yeah. One of the things that we have, I'm going to say we, GCIO has, and I would say that's right in your bailiwick, is the Innovation Lab.
Yep.
Talk to us about that.
So I think it's a work in progress for sure. But I think it's this notion. Look, everybody has a lab. Everybody has this innovation center. There's a lot of those going around. But what we're really trying to do is say, hey, we would like to bring some of these solutions, some of the cloud infrastructure in-house, have our own playground, our own sandbox to play in, to build out these tools and learn, right? So that our people aren't necessarily always learning on the client side or aren't just going to a training class where they get a book learning approach to it.
And real stuff.
They get real stuff, right? And so have real opportunities. And also, you know, as we do and learn things on client projects, bring that back and be able to share that with our other teams. So, for example, you were talking about what we're doing down in Austin with the FSC, where we're helping, you know, sort of drive sort of adoption of some additional tools in the DevOps space around metrics and reporting and how we sort of improve on that. And we're building out that infrastructure. And so we're doing it arguably for them as a proof of concept, but we're doing it in the GCIO lab, right, in our innovation space, so that it's ours and we can show it to other people. We can invite other people within the company to look at it, play with it, maybe, you know, add on to it, augment it, and then we can keep bringing those skills back and forth. So between that and just really giving ourselves, I think, a place where we can bring technologies and try them out and see what works, see what doesn't work. You know, potentially do demos for clients, but also, as I pointed out, maybe use it for real work and get real client solutions in there.
So one of my favorite things in this lab is infrastructure as code.
Yeah.
I think, in my humble opinion, if I have a humble opinion, is that infrastructure as code is going to be a real game changer.
It already is. Right. I mean, there's already.
So you think it's spreading across government or is it there?
I think it's in government. It's very slow in government. Right. Look, government has always had issues around ownership of the assets as well as the security issues. Right. Because they often have lots of privacy information of secure data that has to be for the public good, has to be maintained and kept secure. They always have, there's always a reluctance to be able to let it just go into this nebulous, it's not at my data center, it's somewhere else that I don't know where it is.
Somebody else's computer.
I don't know where it is, and it might move without me knowing about it, and I then really don't know where it is, right? There's that whole risk of, I have no idea where my data is. And so when...
You do, except I used to have... The hand on the power switch. I used to run the network cord. I used to do all those things.
Yeah. I mean, look, the fact was when there was a problem or you had some issue and like an auditor came in and said, where is the data? You could theoretically grab them, walk them down the hall, take them to the data center.
You could grab them a disk.
You could point them to a little box in a rack and say, the data's right there. And I've got armed guards, and I've got people, and I've got all these things that are keeping it
safe.
Not
that that makes it any more secure.
No, but there was a sense that it was more secure. But, you know, I think we've seen the Amazons, the Googles, all the, you know, sort of pretty much every application, every system you work with on the internet, they're all using cloud solutions. They're scaling at will, at on demand. So when it's Black Friday and they're suddenly being pounded with 10 million requests a second, they don't die. Not like, you know, we've had many, like the health exchange, when they opened the healthcare exchange, that all crashed, you know, when it first went live. They just scaled it up and it stays up. If they have little problems, it's incidental. They adapt and adjust and keep going. So there's those kind of things. I think infrastructure as code, to bring that back, right? It enables you to not worry about the infrastructure so much. You're now focused on the application and the service. And then you've already built a standard that already has, again, all your security requirements, all your all the policies and everything already instantiated and built in from the ground up, so that when you deploy an application, it's done right, right? It's already done. And when we talk about, for example, the idea of immutable infrastructure, where instead of, you know, today we take, for example, a database server that we hardened and we secured and we know it's perfectly, you know, it's perfectly exactly what we want it. And what do? Within 2-3 weeks?
We create a snowflake.
We patch it. We patch it, and now we're not quite sure if it's still actually secure.
Is it the same as the one that's over there?
Well, we don't know, right? Because fact is, we took the vendor's word that they gave us this patch that supposedly fixed this thing, and we probably tested to make sure it fixed that thing. We don't know if it broke something else.
But we also didn't codify it so that we could do it again.
Well, yeah.
And then we changed another one because, oh, the other patch came in, and they were like, Greg, did you get that down? He said, oh, don't worry. I really have time for that.
I've been at agencies where, yeah, they've tried to deploy a patch and it failed and they rolled it back. And for 3 months, we weren't patched because they're like, we still can't get that patch working, right? Because they couldn't replicate it. They didn't know why it didn't work. Their infrastructure wasn't standardized enough for them to be able to actually do it one place and say, wow, it worked great there. We know exactly how it works. Now let's move it to this other environment. And, you know, we would often get, it worked there, it worked in dev, it worked in test, it failed in production. We don't know why.
Snowflakes.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't anything they intentionally did, right? It was just the fact that every system was constantly in a state of flux. It was always being updated, patched,
configuration
everything.
Drift kills me.
Whereas when you look at like immutable code, right? For the people that aren't familiar with that, that's this idea that every time you deploy a change, a patch or anything.
But infrastructure as code, I think, is really going to hit home in testing. Because in the old days, Greg, you used to go and try and get a test environment together. Well, you did your finances. Like, this is how it used to work for you young guys. You used to go and get the production environment, finance. Oh, okay, great. They grovel. They finally give you that. Then you go back and you would actually ask for the test environment. First, they would laugh. Then they would tell you no. And then you'd kind of try and fit it in and try to scale it and try to figure out how to work. And then you'd have these things that would be out there to test would kind of look like prod. You kind of, you know, take that's crazy. So now I can scale up, kill it off. I can scale up, do my testing at the production-like scale, and then kill it off.
Yeah, and look,
cost saving is amazing, flexibility is amazing, and I grow with my application.
That's always been a problem, right? Because typically, like the developers, I've been places where the developers want 7 environments, right? Maybe it's a mission critical system, and they literally want, you know,
they always want another environment.
They always wanted. There's always an excuse. Like I've heard one, they wanted one just for training. They wanted one so that the users could have one to play with and to test and training. They wanted one for support, so that when the real system didn't work, the testers could go in and see if it worked in the, you know, the stable environment.
I never came up with that one.
I've seen it all. But the problem was always, you hit it right on the head, right? Is that there's always this cost associated with that, right? It was, I had to buy and hardware.
It. Yeah.
And I had to put it somewhere.
Like, it's not good.
Yeah. And so it's just a headache and nobody wanted to pay for it. And again, you always end up with this barrier. It was like, well, production has 10 servers. Well, can you do test with 3?
I could.
We can.
But and here's then, the risk.
Yeah. And the risk is often the ones that really happen in production, right? All of a sudden, the system falls over, and we don't know why it didn't handle the load.
Well, it did great at 3.
It did great at 3.
But it didn't do good at 7. Yeah. And that's when I was making my
money. In fact, it turns out it can only run on 6, and at the 7th, it doesn't even use, right? For some reason.
Too.
Right? You know what I mean? It's often there's some barrier, like it can only hold 32 threads. After 32, the system just won't work anymore.
Right, right.
We didn't license that.
So with a cloud, where is that? How is the government in adopting the cloud in your mind? Where are we at right now?
I think we're where we wanted to be about 4 or 5 years ago, right? So I think when the cloud really kind of came out and people really started talking about it, I think there were a lot of agencies that there's some agencies that were wanting to run, right? They were eager to go over there and try it out, and they saw the value and the benefit. And I mean, look, you saw a lot of federal agencies that actually became effectively cloud providers to other agencies, right? They built a data center. They built that sort of infrastructure that allowed them to procure things in a virtual environment, and they were able to successfully give that to other agencies. But for the most part, most of the agencies ran afoul of policies and procedures or security or anything that just sort of really didn't look at that change and value it, right? Again, you know, security is the easy one to point out, but it was just...
Security's got a tough job.
It does.
I don't want your job, but I also am just baffled at sometimes I'm trying to get them involved. But I understand, okay, because they can't really win. They can only lose. They're like the network guys. You don't call up the network guy and go, I just want to let you know, Greg, that thing is really running great. Nobody gives you that call, right?
No.
But security gets the call like, I can't believe we got hacked again.
Look, the problem is they often are left out of it. They have no say. They're not really given a full seat at the table in many cases, or hadn't been historically.
Or don't want it.
Or don't want it. Or
because they have this arm's length is a good approach, right? It's part of the whole security doctrine.
My early career, the expectation was the security was going to say no. They were just going to say no. If it was something they had already approved, it's no.
Even if I approve it, I just need to do it again, so no.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was just it, right? That was effectively, they thought that was their job, right? No. Arguably with the cloud, I think agencies are finally, they've had enough time to get familiar with it, to see what it can do. And I think arguably what's happened is there's agencies like the intelligence community, like the NSA and all those guys who have embraced it wholeheartedly. And, you know, it's harder and harder. It used to be agencies would be able to say, but there's nobody else in the cloud with security requirements like we have.
Now you're becoming the exception if you're not doing it. Is that what
exactly.
you're saying?
Exactly. Because, I mean, it's kind of hard. Like, I've been agency where like, oh, we have unique security concerns. And I'm like, the CIA, the NSA, all those three-letter agencies, they've been there for 5 years. And they are quite happy. I mean, they're doing their job, and when's the last time you heard anything even about there was some, you know, incident of security, you know, hint of a security issue or anything? Because you know it would get out, right? You know they'd probably squash it. But at the same time, you also know there'd be some rumblings or there'd be something in the, you know, you'd eventually hear some rumors. You're not hearing that because they figured out how to make it secure, how to do it the right
way. Yeah, so the cloud platforms are maturing too.
Yeah.
So that's good. So we have FedRAMP and all those kind of opportunities for people to get on.
And let's be honest, right? So, you know, quite honestly, a lot of large-scale application deployments in the federal government don't always go the way they were intended.
Not just in the government, by
historically,
the way.
No, not just in the government, across industry. But look, historically, by the time you realize it's a failure, you've already spent millions upon millions of dollars in infrastructure. You've got all this sunk costs. You know, that you've had, you know, your point, you're trying to amortize it over 5 years and depreciate it. When you're in the cloud, you've lost that. You don't have that investment anymore, right? I can literally walk over to a guy and say, kill it, and it's all dead. It's just gone. So I think there's an opportunity there where people can try things and it can fail, right? And if it doesn't work well, you know, shame on us if we went too long, but we can also just call it quits. There's no other costs associated. We've just, you know, whatever's been spent at this point is gone. We learned and we move on.
So I was just talking with Nicholas Shallon. He's the chief software officer with the Air Force, and they have Kessel Run as an example of software factories. And these software factories are able to be created, much like we just talked about, brought up, configured with the tools that make sense for the product that you're creating, and then blown away. And they can come and go. Also, what's really great is when you talk about immutable infrastructure within your development environment, so they're continually patching not just what they produce, but what they are producing the product on. Pretty amazing. Talk to us about some of that, what we're doing in the lab.
Look, I think the idea, I think there's been an acknowledgement. So historically, agencies, companies, anybody has often wanted to establish standards, right? So we're familiar with, for example, technical reference models, where there's a set of approved things. And I think what we're finding more and more is that we are trying to do something new, or we're trying to do something modern, and our tools aren't on that list. And it's always a barrier. I mean, you know, there's just a certain barrier that comes with it. It's such a hard ordeal to get it on the list that people don't even want to start.
Yeah, it's like an award you get if you get on the list. Yeah,
exactly.
Right? And you're not going to get off the list.
Yeah, exactly. So, but at the same time, I think we certainly have seen, and you can look at it in the software development space, that the tools, the types of code that's being developed, the architectures are changing every 6 months to a year. And, you know, the things like I worked with a project that 5 years ago, they were doing the modern thing, Ruby on Rails. And these days, trying to find Ruby developers is actually a pretty challenging, you know, at that scale.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah. Because that was the thing du jour at the time, and it was great, but now it's not. And so imagine if you had made a play 5 years ago where all the Ruby on Rails tools and code, you know, things that you need for that environment were all on your TRM, and you didn't put Java or any of the Java tools on your TRM, you would be in a state, because all of a sudden all your people want to be doing Java development and you don't have the tools in place. So I think the idea is just acknowledging this desired state configurations, and this whole notion is we don't know, we can no longer just establish a set of tools and say that's the tools that we're all going to use.
No golden set.
There's no golden set.
So we don't need a golden set. We should twist it around saying, yeah, I get requirements, technical requirements and product requirements, and this is the
correct
set of tools I need, and then be able to fire those up.
Yeah, sure. But we need to stay away from that wild, wild west mentality.
And we can too.
Sure. Yeah.
We can do that without saying, okay, Greg, here's a set of tools that you picked. They're way off for the TRM. Thanks a lot. I hope you behave yourself and you put them out there in a way that we think should be. But we can actually control those now with the undesired state configuration.
Correct, right? Because part of it, it's not, you know, look, when you hand those over to a software development team, they have a certain set of goals and objectives, and they're going to do those. And they're probably going to do a great job of configuring those tools for that. But there's going to be other needs and requirements that aren't really important to them that maybe the rest of the agency needs. For example, metrics into how all that software development's going.
Oh, metrics. We're going to talk
or,
metrics?
You know, reports for security to make sure everything they like it. Or even, and really with like agencies like the VA and others, we own this code. We need to put it in our own repository where we can get to it after this contract is over and these contractors disappear, right? That happens. And often I've been places where, you know, they decide to start up development on an old system and we can't find the source code.
Oh.
Right? Or it's in a format nobody can read anymore because we don't have those tools. So, I mean, look, there's this – I think our desired state configuration was about, look, we have to allow people to use different sets of tools because things constantly are changing.
But that desired state is understood, is codified, saved.
Correct.
And it can be recreated each and every time.
You've got somebody who's curating those tools for them.
Go.
So when people say, hey, we need the latest version of Jenkins, you're like, okay. Somebody is looking at it saying, that's great. And here's how we can make sure it's configured not just for this one instance, but for widespread use across the agency. Huh. And it's consistent, right?
Okay,
and
so you brought up metrics. Talk to me about metrics.
I'm sorry.
Continuous measurement improvement, metrics and KPIs and SLAs.
Well, look, I think we've come to a point in that we realize that we need to be constantly measuring what we're doing and how we're doing it so that we can constantly improve. And so we can find out, you know, it's not just – what we don't want is we don't want the standard, right, which is you have a project manager who's running a project and they go to a status meeting and they say, everything's great. And they go, And they've maybe hit some milestones, some dates of it, and everything's great. What you don't know is how much technical debt they're, building up behind them that they're not sharing with you, or the fact that they're running towards some major hurdle that they're gonna, they're gonna hit a wall, and they're just ignoring it. And you know, it happens all the time. I mean, again, the healthcare exchange is a perfect example where I'm sure that project was, you know, on track up until like 6 months before deployment when all hell broke loose, the wheels fell off, and they suddenly realized, anything more than five people using the system at once, it's not going to handle it. Oops, we've got to do something else. So the idea being is that we've got metrics. So we have, for example, we have a CI/CD pipeline where every time code's being checked in, it's being tested. And those results are being reported so that other people can look at it and say, oh, yeah, it's actually working. The performance test is automatically being done. We're not waiting till later to make sure. We're not trusting somebody is going to tell us that. We've got the numbers. We're seeing the velocity. We're seeing that that the technical debt's not building up to a point where we're going to have to address it, right? I mean, or technical debt's building up and we need to address it. So, for example, we had a recent opportunity where we were suggesting a team, you know, a separate development team that was focused solely on just removing some of the technical debt, because we recognized that while you've got all these new whiz-bang features and things you want to do, we've got all this stuff that's been building up for months or years that needs to be addressed. Because if we don't, you know, at some point, again, we'll hit that wall and the whole thing will fall apart.
So let's wrap it up here. I'll give you an opportunity to give us some vision of where GCIO is going and maybe some opportunities that you see in government over the next couple of years. What's hot?
You know, there's a lot of talk these days in the artificial intelligence space, right? I mean, that's something I think everybody's getting into. Everybody starts realizing, you know, you've got your series and your other assistants out there that are helping, and you've got, I mean, you know, there's just, look, the applications of AI and machine learning are almost endless, right? And there's a lot of people out there that are claiming they can do it. There's a lot of different solutions out there. I think that's certainly something that everybody's going to be looking at, right? It's something I think that we need to be looking at hard and seeing how we can, you know, what's our role in that space. I think we also need to acknowledge, though, that like a lot of those solutions are actually based on having well-structured, well-understood, clean data. And you can't do all those really cool whiz-bang things if you don't have that. And that actually is one of the biggest challenges I think agencies face, because even, you know, I've been places where, for example, they were working with various universities across the United States and you can't agree on how Alabama is spelled, right? Because people typed it slightly different ways let me give you a real example.
I can see Mississippi, but not Alabama.
University of Texas. I could put it in the system of U of T. Did I mean U of University of Texas or University of Tennessee? Right. And you get all sorts of things like that where, you know, different people have, you know, there's names that are very common to each other. They just type them wrong. They get input system right. So you end up with, instead of one university, you end up with 15 or 20 of them. And suddenly you can't do the analysis you thought you would, you know, you have to clean the data before you can actually do the analysis you were trying to do. And you just extract that. I mean, you look at, like, let's take the Veterans Affairs, where they've got veterans filling out forms asking for benefits. Are you sure that they put their name the exact same way every time? Probably not. Are you sure if they didn't have good handwriting and somebody's having to key that into a system that it got keyed in correctly? What about their address changing? What about, you know, what if they meant to put a 5 and they put an 8 instead? We thought it was an 8. You know, there's all these things that just crop into the data, and next thing you know, we've, you know. Look, I can share you with my example is the fact that my father and I have very similar but not quite the same name. And I get notices every so often from one of the veterans associations suggesting that I should join. And I am not a vet, but my father was. And somewhere in there, our data got commingled. And so now, apparently, I am a retiree who, you know, ought to be joining the American Foreign Legion. So,
and look, you know, at least don't join the Foreign Legion, okay?
I mean, and that's kind of like, I don't know. But I mean, look, the fact is that's an area that I think is certainly ripe for people like us to get into, is artificial intelligence and applying it to some of the problems that we face and our clients face. But also, you know, arguably when we start looking at like the data side of things and how do we get the data in a shape that we can do these advanced analysis and do some of these really cool things that are out there.
Yeah, no doubt. There's a lot of opportunity in artificial intelligence, machine learning out there. So, Greg, thank you very much for coming down. Appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
And look forward to having you on the podcast again soon.
I appreciate it.
The Agile Advocate is a production of Government CIO Media and Research. For more podcasts, head to governmentcio.com/podcasts. The Agile Advocate is produced by Amy Kluber. It is hosted by Bill Drew. Edited by Resonate Recordings. Theme music provided by Big Hoax. If you're interested in sponsoring a podcast, contact us at sponsor@governmentcio.com.